Well, the law most relevant to the Sean Bell police trial says police officers may use deadly force only if they believe that they or someone else are in immediate mortal danger. Keywords, if they believe. The challenge for the prosecution was to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that officers in this case did not really believe such a danger existed or so bungled the job that they caused themselves to believe danger existed when it did not. Closing arguments were delivered for 7 grueling hours yesterday in the case. Now it's all up to Judge Arthur Cooperman, who will rule without a jury. We've been following the evidence with weekly segments on this program. Let's review the closing arguments with Nicole Bodie covering the trial for the Daily News and Michael Wilson covering it for the New York Times. Hi, Mike. Hi, Nicole. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
And Michael, from what I gather, one main line of argument yesterday comes down to rage versus fear. The prosecution says the cops were so filled with rage at having Ms. Nora's leg and their vehicle struck by Bell's car that they fired 50 unnecessary shots. The defense says they were so afraid of the gun that they thought was about to come out from Guzman that they had to act. How much is it now about rage versus fear?
Well, the rage kind of factor was only just introduced yesterday with Testa Gross's remarks.
The prosecutor, and he used that word, right?
Yes. He had spent the better part of the 3 hours at that point dismantling their reasons that they claimed for shooting. Arguing that there was no threat, there was no gun. They could see that with their own two eyes. So then, he almost has to give some reason. How could this happen? So that's when he mentioned the rage.
Mm-hmm. And Nicole, did fear come up as a word used by the defense, if you remember particularly? Because it does seem to sort of come down to that. These were officers in a murky, tough situation. Things were crashing into, cars and people, and Guzman was reaching for his waist, and they had reason to fear.
Absolutely. When the lawyer for Michael Oliver, a lawyer by the name of James Culleton, went through his closing statements, one of the things that was unusual he was the only one to do it, is he actually read a portion of Detective Oliver's grand jury testimony word for word. And as part of that testimony, Detective Oliver himself said, "I didn't want to die." So certainly the defense is relying heavily on the fear for their own lives, fear for each other's lives, fear for civilians in the area. So absolutely fear is a central point in the determination and justification for the defense.
On the relationship between the car and the alleged gun and this fear, it seems to me that one thing where the officers have a lot of explaining to do is explain this. Bell and his friends had an argument with a guy, Kwaku, who then drove away. Detective Isnora, believing Guzman had a gun, followed the three to their car and fired 50 times even though no gun was produced. How much of the arguments yesterday centered on whether they had reason to believe specifically that Guzman was reaching for a gun at that moment? Nicole?
Well, what's interesting about what you said is it's absolutely true. They believed that this man in front of the SUV currently had a gun, that he was displaying his hand in his pocket as if he already had a gun. One of the lawyers representing Detective Isnora said that Detective Isnora believed that Guzman was on his way to get a gun. They didn't believe he had it on him yet.
Mm-hmm.
They were following him to his car where they believed he was going to retrieve this gun and then go and finish off this argument in a deadly way with this SUV driver. So they didn't necessarily need to place a gun on him, but they needed to credibly produce some evidence that there was a reason to think that Joseph Guzman was on his way to get a gun. And the way that they did that was by placing statements or attributing statements to Guzman standing outside of the club Kahlua saying, "Go get my gun," or "Go get my gat," which was allegedly overheard by Detective Isnora and his backup undercover, Detective Hispolito Sanchez, who testified in the trial on the prosecutor's behalf, which was an interesting choice by the prosecutors. And even in their closing statements, the prosecutors admitted that Detective Sanchez was, in fact, the first defense witness, even though he was called by the prosecution.
But, Michael, did the defense argue that the police started shooting because they thought Guzman was going to fire a gun at them,
yes,
or because Sean Bell was knocking them around in their car?
The gun. Isnora has been clear that he has his eyes locked on Guzman and is watching his hands go down to his waist, and that the hands are coming back up, and that any moment there was going to be a gun in that hand firing at him. And that is why he said, I couldn't wait one more second. I had to shoot.
And that's so hard for the judge to deal with, it seems to me, Michael, because that's something that no witness could really establish one way or the other. Did Guzman appear to be reaching for a gun?
Right. Testagrossa, the prosecutor, argued yesterday that you know, it's ridiculous to imagine a person who has a gun pointing at them would put his hands down onto his waist when there's nothing there. There's been, you know, speculation. What if his hands were down there? What was he doing? Well, there's an open cell phone that was found in the floorboard of the car later. Maybe he is fumbling for a telephone or something.
We had civil rights attorney Norman Siegel here recently, and he suggested that Isnora and Michael Cooper were overcharged. Cooper, no. Who's the one who fired 31 shots?
Oliver.
Oliver is what I meant to say. That Isnora and Oliver were overcharged by the grand jury. That instead of manslaughter, which is like they set out to kill Bell, they should have been charged with criminally negligent homicide. That they so messed up the situation in ways they should have known better than to bungle that badly as trained police officers, that they negligently put themselves in a position where they thought they had to shoot. And I'm curious, Mike, was the word negligence used at all by the prosecution in their arguments?
Not in the way that they need to prove it. But more in just a, you know, as a part of the argument in general, they're negligent, they're incompetent, they, you know, they have rage. It's part of that whole collective argument.
Anything to add to that, Nicole?
Yeah, there was some suggestion. There was a window where prosecutors and defense lawyers at the close of arguments, before the closing statements, had an opportunity to suggest criminally negligent homicide as an alternative to the current charges. Neither side took that up. But they could have suggested it. Presumably, the defense would not have wanted to do so because it could have given the judge more of a seemingly reasonable thing to charge them with. So there would be no reason to want to offer that up to the judge. Prosecution haven't mentioned it, but presumably they also would not have wanted to do that because it could have come across as that they didn't have faith in the top charges, which was both intentional and reckless manslaughter, as well as assault and reckless endangerment.
What's the difference between reckless homicide and negligent homicide under the law? Can either of you go there?
Legally, the intentional, it's about the intention. Manslaughter in the first degree, which intentionally setting out to go and kill these men. And I think that is going to be a really stiff bar for this judge to rule, because if you can say a lot of things about the preparations for that night, but an intent to kill doesn't seem to have been presented by either side, one way or the other. It seems like, if anything, there was a lack of intent, or certainly a confusion of intent. Manslaughter in the second degree is a reckless charge, which there's a more open-ended thing, but it could have been a byproduct of your actions, but you didn't have to go about intentionally setting kill these men.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, Norman Siegel, when he was here, said the judge can reduce the charge himself to criminally negligent homicide if he finds that crime was committed, and since it's a lower charge than the reckless homicide that they're accused of, and the judge could decide to find them guilty of that. Is there any buzz among the press corps at this trial that anything like that might happen?
Not that I've heard, Nicole.
No, I haven't heard that as well. Cooperman, the that he seems to have laid out is, I think, was included, Michael, in your story today, was the only thing he said about what he's going to use to judge this case is he just said the law, New York State law. So he's a poker face when it comes to this case, and he hasn't seemed to give any indication about how he will rule, on what grounds he will rule, other than that very stark statement that he made a few days ago.
Michael Daly's column in the Daily News, your paper, Nicole, says today that the judge was sleepy during the prosecution's closing arguments and appeared riveted by Attorney Rico for the defense. Did you see it that way?
It's hard sometimes to get a sense. I mean, certainly he does seem to pay attention to Rico. I think that's fair to say. The closest thing I can say to an expression on the judge's face is that he does that sort of half smile, which he seems to do a lot when Rico is up. Rico makes some very compelling arguments. He's an excellent lawyer, one among many. So, you know, yeah, if I had to say what the judge's state of mind just by the way the look on his face, he was definitely paying attention when Rico was up there.
Michael, what is that half smile? Is it a smirk? Is it a...
It's Mona Lisa.
Read anything you want into it.
It was a very long day. You said grueling 7 hours, and it was towards the... I mean, Testa Grossa was 3 hours in the afternoon, and that's, you know, it's a tough time of day when everyone's getting a little tired, and I thought the judge was kind of losing focus a little bit,
mm-hmm.
as were, like, we all. But that said, Testa Grossa managed to really bring his A game to that argument. I mean, it was really just kind of a new outlook and fresh kind of remarks on individuals and situations that we've heard ad nauseum
like
descriptions
what?
Of.
Like what? Give me another fresh remark or argument from the prosecution.
Well, this idea that, you know, by the way, if Bell didn't know that that was a cop standing there with pointing a gun at him, he's allowed not only to flee, but to hit him with his car.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just kind of statements like that we hadn't heard, like, we hadn't heard of it that way in a while.
Nicole, what else was central to the closing arguments that we haven't mentioned?
Well, one of the things that has been alluded to, but I don't think ever quite as explicitly and as passionately as yesterday, was when Testa Grossa really ripped into the defense corps for cross-examination. He called it as cruel sport. He said that he had never seen such blaming the victim as in this case, that it seemed, you know, and he would lay out all of the different ways that the defense attacked victims, most importantly, two in the car, Joseph Guzman and Trent Benefield, for everything they ever did in their life that could be remotely perceived as criminal, including recording a rap tape in the 1990s.
Yeah.
So he really raked him across the coals for that, which is something we've heard outside the courtroom from anyone related to the family, you know, from day one, but hasn't really come up as an issue inside the courtroom. But he really gave it to them on that regard as well.
Michael, what else?
The looking at Trent Benefield, he called him the personification of the innocent victim. Here's a guy who didn't hear anything about a gun, who no one claims said anything about a gun. All he wanted to do was go, you know, get something to eat, and he jumps in the back seat of the wrong car and gets shot three times. The idea that the police had opportunity for cover, that's something that we've even discussed on the show.
Yeah.
And that was not, you know, a real central sticking point. We heard more testimony about things like a bullet that hit a lampshade than we ever heard about, you know, police opportunities for cover, but Testa Grossa stopped and put up a visual aid and pointed out, like, you know, he could have gone here, he could have gone here, he could have gone here. So.
Well, did either of you find a kind of disconnect between the passion and pointedness of the prosecutor, Testa Grossa, in the closing arguments and the way he presented the case? Because both of you have been on here week after week, along with WNYC's Arun Venugopal, talking about how he had this sort of kitchen sink approach and put on witnesses who kind of made his case, didn't make his case, and had a, you know, lackluster court demeanor. I mean, what happened? What do you make of the difference, Michael?
Well, he didn't have a lot of opportunity to show a lot of flair, and I don't think that's his fault. You know, when the prosecutor just brings forth all these witnesses and police officers and whatnot, there's no real reason for him to get upset or raise his voice or become emotional like he did yesterday. Not emotional, but, you know, use emotion.
But the defense did many times, right?
Yeah,
the
defense
lawyers ratcheted it up time and time again.
Sure, that's cross-examination for you. And Testa Grossa did not have a lot of meaty cross-examination opportunities. There were five defense witnesses, I think, and, you know, two of them mm-hmm. were character witnesses, a pastor and an old friend of his, Nora's, and two other ones were ballistics guys, and he he and the other prosecutors did cross-examine them, but not, you know, in a kind of a heated way that you would cross-examine, say, a Joe Guzman,
mm-hmm.
who's just, you know, giving it back to you in spades in terms of anger and emotion up there.
Nicole, anything on this?
Lester Grossa also acknowledged as much. I wouldn't say he made apologies for you know, what he did or didn't do on the front end emotionally, but he did make a comment during his closing statements where he had presented everything to the court, and that to do anything less would have been to deprive the court of its, you know, rightful, I don't remember the exact words, but basically acknowledging that, yeah, maybe he did throw everything in the kitchen sink at the judge, and maybe he couldn't vouch for every single witness that he had brought up before the judge, but that they felt that because it was a judge deciding this, they had, in every fair way, they had to just present everything that they knew and that it was for the judge to decide. So he did make an allusion to the fact that he was aware that maybe they did present something of a case that was a tad confusing from time to time and was, you know, directly, in conflict sometimes from one witness to the next. But that in fairness to the judge and in fairness to the case, they felt like it was better to present everything than piecemeal.
We've just got a couple of minutes left talking about the closing arguments in the Sean Bell police trial yesterday with Nicole Bodie from the Daily News and Michael Wilson from the New York Times. There's been some talk about Benefield, I think it was, tailoring testimony in the case to help his multi-million-dollar civil suit against the city. Can either of you explain what that's about, why that allegation came up?
That goes back to this this interview that he had with detectives a couple hours after the shooting, after he was in the hospital, and they shot him up with some morphine, and then the detectives questioned him, and he gave an account of what had happened, describing, you know, this guy coming up with a gun and shooting, and Sean Bell backs up and hits a wall and hits a car, hits a van twice. On the witness stand, that all changed. He said, well, I saw the guy with a gun come up, and I put my arm over my eyes, and I felt a collision, and that's it. Then I felt myself get shot, and I ran away. And that is where he's accused of, you know, kind of changing his story to a light most favorable to a, you know, a civil case against the city.
Well, why would that be bad for the criminal case? Could something good for his civil case be bad for his criminal case, or not his, but the case against his, you know, attacker?
Well, it's bad in the sense that if the judge diminished his credibility, if the judge finds him a less credible witness, then it's not helping him in any way in the criminal case.
Also, in a civil case, the criminal onus here is that, just as the prosecutor said, if they genuinely believe that this man was coming up to them with a gun and was not a police officer, and they chose to strike him with their car in an attempt to flee, and they chose to do that consciously, then criminally that might be completely reasonable. Civilly, it might put some of the burden on them in a way that could potentially diminish their claim that they were completely victims of this and had nothing to do with, you know, instigating any of it at all. So for him to suddenly say, well, I covered my eyes, I didn't see anything, I don't know if anybody saw this guy in front of the car, they just drove away and then I got shot, that would seem to protect him in a civil way, that no one could come back to him and say, well, you participated in this, and as a result, you know, that could diminish, mm-hmm. you know, his civil liability.
Michael, your article today says Judge Cooperman announced that he will rule or announce a ruling on next Friday, April 25th. Did he say on April 25th or by April 25th?
On. He may have the thing written now and he's in Florida, but I doubt it. But the
how does he know? I mean, we with a jury, you don't know if they're going to take 6 hours or 6 weeks.
He he gave himself, what, almost 2 weeks, you know, nine working days. So I think he just feels like that's plenty of time.
And maybe he wants it in the buried in the Saturday morning news cycle, along with all the other leaks that we get.
I'm sure there's all kinds of speculation as to the motivation of that timing, and who knows.
There's been some comment that there was a request, whether or not it was explicit or not. The slowest day in the courtroom is a Friday, so strictly for personnel control purposes, if they were going to pick a day to release a verdict in a courtroom, the least packed day being a Friday would be ideal. This Friday being the arrival of the Pope, maybe not so ideal. Oh. So it sounds like it might have been good for everybody for it to be on the 25th.
Well, limbo time begins. Nicole Bodie from the Daily News, Michael Wilson from the New York Times. Thanks, both of you, for coming on with us so many times during the trial. And we'll check back.
Thank you.
Thank you.